Hello, this is the New York Times, Tuesday, January 18th, 2022. I'm Barbara Tobias. And our first story today, Omicron may be peaking in parts of U.S., but hospitals are strained. There's still no guarantee that the population's building enough natural immunity to turn the virus into a mundane part of daily life. Several cruise lines are canceling trips because of the variant. Here's what you need to know. Omicron cases may be peaking in some U.S. states, but COVID is overwhelming hospitals. Two top aides to Pope Francis tested positive for coronavirus. A fourth shot may not offer much more protection against catching Omicron, an early Israeli study suggests. Hong Kong will cull thousands of hamsters after COVID cases in a pet shop. Beijing finds Omicron and claims mail from abroad might be to blame. Experts say that's very unlikely. Australia records its deadliest day of COVID as hospitals in Victoria see a flood of patients. France's education minister draws ire for an Ibiza vacation as school COVID rules were changed. Tonga fears that COVID will arrive with aid workers after a volcano eruption and a tsunami. Omicron prompts more cruise lines to cancel trips. And Hong Kong arrests two former Cathay Pacific flight attendants accused of breaking pandemic rules. A wave of Omicron cases may be cresting in the northeastern United States, but the number of COVID-19 patients is at a record high and climbing, overwhelming hospitals whose staffs have been hollowed out by the coronavirus. Public health leaders warn that while the number of Americans getting infected every day remains dangerously high, there's no guarantee that the population's building enough natural immunity to hasten the day the virus becomes a manageable part of daily life. Dr. Anthony S. Fauci, the government's top infectious disease expert, was asked on Monday at the online World Economic Forum whether this might be the year when that happens. "I would hope that that's the case," he said, "but that would only be the case if we don't get another variant that eludes the immune response." Dr. Fauci said the evolution of the pandemic was still impossible to chart. "The answer is, we don't know," he said. The United States is averaging over 790,000 new daily cases. That's a tally that includes an artificially low count on Monday, when many states did not release new data because of the Martin Luther King Jr. Day holiday. Deaths now exceed 1,900 a day, up 54% over the past 2 weeks. Even before the holiday weekend, daily cases had peaked in New York and other northeastern states, according to a New York Times database. Cases in the region peaked on January 10th and 11th. Although scientists believe that Omicron can cause less severe disease than previous variants, the sheer number of cases has created a tsunami of patients seeking care. Hospitals are under tremendous strain, struggling to manage staffing shortages that force difficult decisions about whose care to prioritize. The average number of Americans hospitalized with the coronavirus is 157,000. That's an increase of 54% over 2 weeks, and the number could continue increasing for some time. Experts say any data on deaths and hospitalizations tend to lag behind pure case numbers by about 2 weeks. The hospitalization figures include people who test positive for the virus after being admitted for conditions unrelated to COVID. The Omicron surge is slamming understaffed hospitals where many workers are sick with COVID-19, and others who quit under the pressure of the pandemic have not been replaced. Intensive care units, as of the week that ended January 13th, were an average 82% full, according to the New York Times database. In Oklahoma City on Monday, four hospitals issued a statement saying they had no ICU beds available. After last week's U.S. Supreme Court ruling that approved the Biden administration's vaccine mandate for healthcare workers, hospitals were bracing themselves for possible resistance and more staff shortages. And while it's too soon to know how this record-shattering wave will shape the pandemic, it's bound to have some impact, said William Hanage, an epidemiologist at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. In due course, the immunity from Omicron or boosters or both will wane and breakthrough infections will be possible, he wrote in a text message. But we expect them to be milder. That's not herd immunity because outbreaks will be possible. However, their consequences will be much less severe. Ron DePasquale, Alyssa Luckpat, Carl Zimmer, and Grace Ashford contributed to this article. In Rome, the Vatican said Tuesday that two of Pope Francis's top aides, Cardinal Pietro Parolin, the Vatican Secretary of State, and his deputy, Archbishop Edgar Pena Pera, had tested positive for the coronavirus. Cardinal Parolin, 67, had light symptoms, while Archbishop Pina Pera, 61, had no symptoms, according to a spokesman for the Vatican, Matteo Bruni. They have self-isolated in their apartments in the Vatican, Mr. Bruni said. Mr. Bruni did not immediately respond when asked in an email whether the Pope had been tested. Ordinarily, the two infected clergymen meet with Francis, who's 85, on a regular basis, but it was not clear on Tuesday when they had last seen the Pope. Francis has been an outspoken supporter of vaccination, which he has called an ethical obligation, though he often appears in public without a mask. Last month, Cardinal Parolin introduced new coronavirus restrictions that affected Vatican employees. In view of the continuation and worsening of the current health emergency and the need to take appropriate measures to counter it and to ensure the safe carrying out of activities, the Cardinal said in the decree, the Vatican further toughened those restrictions this month, calling on employees and visitors to wear an N95 mask when indoors. Starting January 31st, employees will also have to possess a health pass showing proof of vaccination with a booster or recovery from the virus. Those without such proof would be placed on unpaid leave. The health pass requirement also applies to visitors to the Vatican museums and gardens and the papal summer palace at Castel Gandolfo. This article was by Elisabetta Povoletto. And next in this series, a fourth shot may not offer much more protection against catching Omicron. An early Israeli study suggests preliminary results from a small Israeli study examining the effects of a fourth coronavirus vaccine dose suggest that despite an increase in antibody levels, the additional dose a few months after a third shot may not do much more to prevent infection with the Omicron variant. Professor Gili Regev-Yoke, the director of the Infectious Disease Unit at Sheba Medical Center and the leader of the research, cautioned that the results were not yet peer-reviewed, but she said that there was no evidence of any risk from getting a fourth dose and that she supported giving the shots to vulnerable people who might have some benefit from it. She said the study's initial results raised questions about giving the extra dose more broadly, including to generally healthy people in their early 60s. For them, she said, it might be preferable to wait for a newer vaccine adapted to deal with variants like Omicron. On Tuesday, Dr. Sharon Alroy-Priest, a senior official at Israel's health ministry, told Khan Public Radio that the decision to offer a fourth dose to older and more vulnerable people had been correct, since they had produced higher levels of antibodies. Higher levels of antibodies likely would give added protection against serious illness. Initial results from the study show that the fourth dose boosted antibodies fivefold. But Professor Regev-Yoke told reporters that 2 weeks after 154 hospital workers received a fourth dose of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine, the number of participants infected with the coronavirus was only slightly lower than the number of infected in a control group that had not received a fourth shot. The hospital did not release the raw data. The study adds information to the debate over whether a fourth shot is advisable. Israel made the shots available to Israelis age 60 and over and to people who are considered particularly vulnerable before much data was available. The health ministry acknowledged a lack of scientific basis at that time, but said that the rising rates of new cases meant time had run out for deliberating and gathering more data. Israeli data shows that immunity provided by a booster shot begins to wane after a few months, and officials said that any downsides of getting a fourth shot were outweighed by the possibility that it could add protection as Omicron spread. Among scientists, questions remain over whether fourth shots are advisable. Research indicates that COVID vaccines already protect against the worst outcomes, including from the Omicron variant. And while initial boosters in general are recommended in several countries, doses every few months may not be a viable long-term strategy, some experts have said. About 500,000 Israelis have received a fourth dose. Among some Israeli professionals, the rush to give a little-tested fourth dose was a bone of contention from the start. An advisory panel of experts recommended administering it to people age 60 and over, as well as to people with weakened immune systems on December 21st. And Prime Minister Naftali Bennett enthusiastically supported the proposal. But given the lack of knowledge about Omicron then, or the effectiveness of a fourth dose, some experts called the idea premature. Israel's Ministry of Health approved rolling out the fourth vaccine for those 60 and older in early January. It was not immediately clear whether the news from Sheba would slow the uptake among people eligible to receive a fourth dose. This was by Isabel Kirshner. And next, Hong Kong will cull thousands of hamsters after COVID cases in a pet shop. Hong Kong will cull more than 2,000 hamsters and ban the import of small animals after a pet shop worker, a customer, and at least 11 hamsters tested positive for the Delta variant of the coronavirus. Officials said on Tuesday it wasn't clear that the virus had been transmitted to humans from imported hamsters, but they called on residents to surrender hamsters imported since December 22nd to be tested and euthanized to prevent any further spread. They're excreting the virus, and the virus can infect other animals, other hamsters, and also human beings, said Thomas Sitt, assistant director of Hong Kong's Agriculture, Fisheries, and Conservation Department. We don't want to cull all the animals, but we have to protect public health and animal health. We have no choice. We have to make a firm decision. The cluster was traced to a worker at the Little Boss Pet Shop in the Causeway Bay district of Hong Kong Island, who was confirmed on Monday to have contracted the Delta variant. Further tests uncovered another infection in a customer who had a brief transaction with the worker while exchanging a cage and buying hamster food with her daughter on January 7th. A preliminary test indicated that the customer's husband had also contracted the coronavirus. Further testing found 11 infected hamsters in the shop and positive samples from cages at the company's warehouse. Health officials said they had found no precedent for pet hamsters passing the coronavirus to humans, but noted that hamsters had been infected in laboratories. Officials said that two shipments of hamsters from the Netherlands were particularly worrying, including about 1,800 brought in on December 22nd and more than 800 that arrived on January 7th. All hamsters at the city's 34 licensed shops will be seized for testing and then culled, officials said. Anyone who bought a hamster after December 22nd is asked to surrender the animal to be tested and euthanized. Pet shops that sell hamsters will also be closed for cleaning, and the authorities will test the shop's rabbits, chinchillas, and guinea pigs. Shops may reopen once those animals are shown to not be infected. Hong Kong, which has a painful history of infectious disease, including nearly 300 deaths from SARS in 2003, has taken aggressive measures to cut the risk of animal transmissions in the past. In 1997, it slaughtered more than 1 million chickens, every chicken in the territory, to stop the spread of an avian flu virus. And the city has since carried out smaller culls when infected birds are found. This article was by Austin Ramsey. And next, the hostages escape, but synagogues ask, how can they be more secure? The hostages whispered instructions and edged closer to the door, part of invaluable training that anxious congregations are using. This is by Ruth Graham, J.C. Fortin, and Troy Clausen. For 11 hours, the hostages talked to the ranting gunman, hoping that he would see them as human. They whispered about strategies, and they surreptitiously edged toward the nearest exit. But when the gunman ordered the men to kneel, they decided they had to take action. The rabbi grabbed a chair and heaved it at the gunman. The hostages ran for the door. The rabbi, Charlie Crichton Walker, has been called heroic for his cool head and the decisive leadership that led to the dramatic escape of three hostages on Saturday from Congregation Beth Israel of Colleyville in suburban Fort Worth, Texas. But by his own account on Monday and that of another hostage, Jeffrey Cohen, it was years of security training, prompted by threats to synagogues that allowed them to escape. In an interview, Rabbi Crichton Walker said he had taken part in at least four separate trainings in recent years from the Colleyville Police Department, the FBI, the Anti-Defamation League, and the Secure Community Network, a nonprofit group that provides security resources to Jewish institutions nationally. The sessions taught him that if you get in this situation, you have to do whatever you can, he said. It gave me the courage and the sensibility to act when we were able. Acts of sudden violence have become a grim part of American life. In cities and small towns, churches, schools, and concert venues have become the settings for terrifying scenes of mayhem. Synagogues have been even more acutely aware of threats since 2018, when an assailant armed with an AR-15-style assault rifle and multiple handguns entered the Tree of Life congregation in Pittsburgh on a Saturday morning. The man, who was shouting anti-Semitic slurs, killed 11 people. The Jewish community security world is looking at as pre-Tree of Life and post-Tree of Life, said Stuart Frisch, a national training and exercise advisor at the Secure Community Network. In August, Mr. Frisch provided an hours-long training session to Rabbi Crichton Walker and several dozen congregants in the sanctuary at Congregation Beth Israel. Jonathan Greenblatt, who leads the Anti-Defamation League, said that Jewish congregants and synagogue leaders are more actively participating. "They've all done active shooter drills," he said. "They've all learned how to handle a hostage situation. They've all learned how to cope with terrorism." Rabbi Crichton Walker compared the courses he took to CPR training, noting that it's rarely needed, but crucial when the moment arises. "This kind of instruction is necessary for all of us as a society," he said, "whether it's synagogues or grocery stores or mosques or shopping malls. It can happen." On Sunday, President Biden called the Colleyville attack an act of terror, and the FBI was investigating it as a terrorism-related matter. The suspect, Malik Faisal Akram, a 44-year-old British citizen, died, according to the police. Mitchell D. Silber, the executive director of the Community Security Initiative at the Jewish Community Relations Councils of New York, said there was a palpable fear that copycat attacks could occur in the coming weeks. "More and more, the Jewish community has accepted that, unfortunately, what it means to be a Jew in the United States in 2022 is that your institutions need to have guards, checkpoints, and security," Mr. Silber said. The training in Colleyville helped the hostages escape. Mr. Cohen, who is identified on the synagogue's website as its vice president, said in a Facebook post on Monday that the training from the Secure Community Network saved our lives. "I'm not speaking in hyperbole here." He described a series of subtle strategies that set up the hostages with the opportunity to make an escape. When he was instructed to sit down, he chose a row with clear access to an exit. When he had an opportunity to rub a fellow hostage's shoulders, he whispered to him about the exit door. And when pizza was delivered, he suggested another hostage retrieve it from the door. Eventually, all the hostages were within 20 feet of the exit. At another point, Mr. Cohen used his feet to slowly move chairs in front of himself to potentially divert bullets or shrapnel. In the beginning, there were four hostages, Rabbi Crichton Walker said, and they were able to build enough goodwill with the gunmen that one of them was released around 5 p.m. The others remained as night fell, but conversations with law enforcement were not going well. "There was a lot more yelling, a lot more threatening," Rabbi Citron Walker said. By around 9 p.m., the three men were near enough to an exit and were poised to run if the opportunity arose, he said. There was a real immediacy. Mr. Cohen wrote that he was prepared to wrap his prayer shawl around Mr. Akram's neck or shooting hand, but he didn't get the chance. When Mr. Akram instructed the hostages to get on their knees, he wrote, "I reared up in my chair, stared at him sternly. I think I slowly moved my head and mouthed, 'No.' At that moment, Rabbi Citron Walker told the men to run, threw the chair, and bolted for the exit, where a SWAT team ushered them to safety. Law enforcement then entered the building. "We escaped," Mr. Cohen wrote in his account on Facebook. "We weren't released or freed." Their escape, however, won't be the last word on how to handle security. The Colleyville attack is likely to force congregations to debate something central to a congregation's sense of self, just how wide to open their doors. Mr. Akram was let in as an act of kindness. Rabbi Citron Walker said that he had let the stranger in before Shabbat services that morning. It was an unusually cold day in North Texas, and the rabbi thought he was just coming in to get warm. He said he made the man some hot tea. Stacy Silverman, until recently a member of Congregation Beth Israel, wondered why Mr. Akram would have been let inside on a Saturday morning. After the deadly shootings at the Tree of Life Temple in Pittsburgh and Chabad Poway in Poway, California, Ms. Silverman said the congregation began locking the doors consistently. More American synagogues seem to be embracing security measures, like the ones in Europe, said Mr. Greenblatt, who leads the Anti-Defamation League. In Europe, Jews have learned to live from Istanbul to Madrid to London, Paris, Berlin, Brussels, Copenhagen, with very intense security precautions, he said. And what I would suggest to you is that a number of leaders in our community are concerned that that is now here. Over the weekend, the Jewish Federations of North America announced it was speeding up the launch of the $54 million program to drastically expand its security initiatives. The Secure Community Network is a partner in the effort. Rabbi Jeffrey Myers, who survived the massacre at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, took classes on security and situational awareness through the Jewish Federation shortly before the shooting there. "I'm alive today because of that kind of training," he reflected on Monday. "The sense of sanctuary that houses of worship in America used to be able to provide has disappeared." As it is, the anxieties spurred by the hostage taking in Texas have reverberated across communities in the New York City region, which is home to more than a million Jews, the world's largest Jewish population outside of Israel. The New York Police Department temporarily sent extra patrols to several synagogues and key Jewish institutions around the city over the weekend, though they had not yet received any credible threats. At Park East Synagogue, a modern Orthodox congregation on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, Benny Ruganitsky, a cantor, said that leaders are always on high alert. Still, after Saturday's hostage-taking spurred deeper anxieties among congregants, the synagogue plans to post additional security guards at entrances and closely monitor foot traffic. You think to yourself that if this goes to Texas in a tiny community where so few people attending services, it can really happen anywhere, Cantor Roganetsky said, adding that finding a balance between safety and neighborliness has become a significant challenge. It's a very, very sensitive line that we have to walk, he said. You want the house of God to be a place that's open to people. If you walk past our building and get into the synagogue and you see two or three armed security guards, that doesn't give you a feeling of closeness or intimacy with God. Margarita Birnbaum contributed reporting to this article. And next, daily business briefing. AT&T will delay 5G service at some airports after airlines warn of flight chaos. It wasn't clear whether the wireless company's new plan would be enough to satisfy airline executives and regulators who have warned about flight cancellations because of interference concerns. This article is by Niraj Chokshi and David McCabe. AT&T said on Tuesday it would wait to turn on new 5G cellular service near some airports, an attempt to address concerns that the company's equipment would interfere with airplane equipment when the service started on Wednesday. The telecom company said in a statement that it had voluntarily agreed to temporarily defer turning on a limited number of towers around certain airport runways while it continued to work with the aviation regulators. It wasn't immediately clear whether the company's decision would satisfy airlines and aviation safety regulators. We're launching our advanced 5G services everywhere else, as planned, with the temporary exception of this limited number of towers, an AT&T representative said in the statement. The company didn't say at which airports it will delay activating the new service, which will expand coverage of the fast next-generation 5G network. Verizon, which is also slated to turn on its own new service on Wednesday, declined to comment. AT&T's announcement came just after the executives of several airlines and others in the aviation industry sent a letter to the Transportation Secretary, Pete Buttigieg, saying that they feared chaos at airports and cargo hubs because of restrictions put in place by aviation regulators to avoid interference between the new wireless service and plane equipment used during takeoffs and landings. Every one of the passenger and cargo carriers will be struggling to get people, shipments, planes, and crews where they need to be, the executive said. To be blunt, the nation's commerce will grind to a halt. On a day like this past Sunday, more than 1,100 flights would have been canceled because of FAA restrictions put in place for the 5G rollout, affecting about 100,000 passengers, the group said. The new 5G service uses so-called C-band frequencies, which are close to the portion of airwaves used by radio altimeters, devices that determine the distance between the planes and the ground. That measurement is particularly important to pilots when visibility is limited. Several major companies and Airlines for America, the industry's trade organization that organized the letter, did not immediately provide estimates for how many flights would be canceled on Wednesday if the 5G rollout happens as planned. In a separate statement on Monday, United Airlines estimated that the disruptions would affect 1.25 million United passengers and at least 15,000 flights annually. The airline group offered a solution in the letter. Allow 5G to be put in place nationwide starting on Wednesday, except for within 2 miles of affected airport runways. Airlines and the FAA had raised concerns about 5G interference over the past several years, but began escalating warnings in recent months, leading Verizon and AT&T to delay their limited 5G rollout from December to early January, and again to this Wednesday. The latest delay came after the FAA, which is part of Mr. Buttigieg's department, reached an agreement at the start of January. The FAA said at the time it would no longer ask for further delays after Verizon and AT&T agreed to the most recent postponement. At the time, Airlines for America said in a statement that it would continue to work with all stakeholders to help ensure that the new 5G service can coexist with aviation safely. The telecommunications industry has pushed back against the concerns raised by the airlines and the FAA, noting that the implementation of 5G has been years in the making and that the service has already been introduced in Britain, France, and other countries without incidents. In our opinion, the technical information that's being used to generate concern shows improbable worst-case scenarios, GSMA, a global wireless industry group, said on Monday. The FAA has noted, however, that there are technical differences in how 5G is being carried out in other countries. In the United States, planes would be protected from 5G interference only in the last 20 seconds of flight, compared with 96 seconds in France, for example. The temporary power limits that U.S. wireless companies agreed to are still about 2.5 times higher than the permanent limits used in France, according to information the agency posted online. Last week, the FAA started issuing hundreds of notices to airlines, providing updated guidance on how to land planes safely in low-visibility conditions where 5G service is of concern. On Sunday, the agency said it had cleared an estimated 45% of the U.S. commercial plane fleet to perform such landings safely, opening up runways at as many as 48 of the 88 airports most directly affected by potential 5G interference. The FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, which distributes wireless spectrum, did not immediately respond to a request for comment. And next, Microsoft will buy Activision Blizzard, a bet on games being central to the Internet's future. This is by Karen Weiss, Kellen Browning, Michael J. de la Merced, and Andrew Ross Sorkin. Microsoft said on Tuesday it planned to buy the powerhouse but troubled video game company Activision Blizzard for nearly $70 billion, betting that video games will become an increasingly central part of people's digital lives. The blockbuster acquisition, the largest ever by Microsoft and for the gaming world, would catapult the company into a leading spot in a $175 billion industry that's successful on virtually every kind of device, from bulky gaming consoles to mobile phones, and has reached even greater heights during the pandemic. Technology companies are swarming around the industry looking for a bigger share of attention and money from the world's 3 billion gamers. In an industry driven by blockbuster franchises, Activision makes some of the most popular titles, including Call of Duty and Candy Crush. Yet the company has been roiled by employee revolt over accusations of sexual harassment and discrimination in recent months. The deal may also strengthen the company's hand in the so-called metaverse. That's the nascent world of virtual and augmented reality. The metaverse is more of a buzzword than a thriving business now, but it has attracted huge amounts of investment and talent. Facebook renamed its parent company to Meta late last year to underscore its commitment. Phil Spencer, the chief executive of Microsoft's gaming business, said that whatever the metaverse may end up being, gaming will be at the forefront of making that mainstream. For now, he said, the acquisition was about gaining a stronghold in mobile gaming, where Microsoft barely competes, and a studio that produces blockbuster games. He called Call of Duty one of the amazing entertainment franchises on the planet. Federal regulators may raise concerns about the acquisition, as Democrats and Republicans alike have pushed to limit the power of technology giants. Microsoft is valued at more than $2.3 trillion, second only to Apple. The industry has been consolidating rapidly as it spends heavily on technology. The takeover of Activision would make Microsoft the world's third largest gaming company by revenue, behind Tencent and Sony, the company said. Microsoft now makes Xbox consoles and owns studios that produce hits like Minecraft. One main driver of deals, and one that could grab the attention of regulators, is the arms race for exclusive content. After locking up well-known franchises like Call of Duty, Microsoft can decide whether to make those games exclusive to their platforms, meaning fans of those games would be forced to switch from Sony's PlayStation console to Microsoft's rival Xbox system. When asked whether Activision games would become exclusive to Xbox, Mr. Spencer would say only that our goal is to allow the content to reach as many players as possible. Microsoft has been hunting for ways to spend its immense cash reserve, more than $130 billion, to expand its consumer business, having looked at acquiring the booming social network TikTok and popular chat app Discord. In Activision, which faces accusations that senior executives ignored sexual harassment and discrimination, Microsoft found a target under stress. The allegations have weighed on Activision, with its shares falling 27% since California sued the company in July over the matter. The game maker's shares opened up nearly 30% in trading on Tuesday. Microsoft shares fell by 2%. The transaction may be seen as a victory for Bobby Kotick, Activision's longtime chief executive, whom some critics had sought to force out over the controversy. Mr. Kotick negotiated a big premium for investors. Microsoft is paying $95 a share, roughly 45% above his company's stock price before the announcement, though only slightly more than the trading price before the scandal broke. Mr. Kotick declined to say if he would remain chief executive after the deal closes, when the studio would report to Mr. Spencer. "Post-close, I will be available as needed to ensure that we have the very best integration," Mr. Kotick said. The controversy at Activision began last summer when a California employment agency sued the company over accusations of fostering a toxic workplace culture in which women were routinely sexually harassed and discriminated against. In the ensuing months, employees staged protests, launched social media campaigns, and called for executives to resign. Some top leaders at Activision did leave, including J. Allen Brack, the head of the Blizzard Entertainment subsidiary, and the company pledged $250 million toward increasing employee diversity and said it would strengthen anti-harassment policies. But when the Wall Street Journal reported in November that Mr. Kotick had known for years about accusations of harassment against employees, and in some cases had not taken action, calls for his resignation only increased. Doing a deal with Activision is something of an about-face for Microsoft, which as recently as November was questioning the company's culture. In an email to Xbox employees reported by Bloomberg and confirmed by the company, Mr. Spencer wrote in November he was disturbed and deeply troubled by the horrific events and actions at Activision. On Tuesday, he was appearing alongside Mr. Kotick to praise the deal, and Mr. Kotick said that he felt the two companies have similar values and think about our cultures similarly. Mr. Spencer said Microsoft sat down with Bobby and the team and looked at the plan that they have in place, adding that company culture is always a work in progress. We're very supportive of the progress that he and the team are making. Current and former Activision employees who have been leading the efforts to get the company to reform its culture did not think the purchase was likely to prompt change in the short term, especially because the sale may face a long review from regulators. The deal could take 12 to 18 months to close, Mr. Spencer said. We'll continue to fight for improvement and stress proper employee representation, said Jessica Gonzalez, a former Activision employee and one of the organizers of the A Better ABK activist movement, adding, "This doesn't change anything." Game companies, which have been flush with cash since the pandemic increased the industry's profits, have been consolidating rapidly. The previous record for the biggest merger in the game industry was set just last week when Take-Two Interactive, the creator of games like Grand Theft Auto, announced plans to buy the mobile publisher Zynga for more than $11 billion. Last year, Electronic Arts and Take-Two engaged in a bidding war over Codemasters, a racing game company, eventually selling to EA for $1.2 billion. And Microsoft made another splashy purchase in 2020 when it purchased ZeniMax Media and its slate of gaming studios for $7.5 billion. Activision itself was the product of serial deal-making by Mr. Kotick over decades, rolling up smaller game studios. It took shape in its current form when Activision, then known primarily for producing titles for traditional gaming consoles, agreed to combine with the gaming unit of Francis Vivendi to expand into multiplayer online games like World of Warcraft. Activision later bought King, the European gaming company behind Candy Crush, to expand into mobile games. Mr. Kotick characterized the deal as a calculation that Activision didn't have the tools to keep up with big tech companies like Google and Apple and Amazon and Tencent in the rapidly evolving gaming landscape. We realized it was going to be an increasingly competitive world with resources that we just didn't have. Microsoft, despite owning the Xbox gaming console and the studios behind Minecraft and Halo, has remained largely focused on corporate users for software like Office 365, and especially Azure, its cloud computing business that competes with the likes of Amazon and Google. Activision's gaming efforts are facing headwinds with its most recent Call of Duty release panned by gamers and delays among titles like Diablo and Overwatch, which have seen key directors leave in recent months after the company's series of scandals. Still, Activision remains quite profitable, reporting $639 million in net income in its most recent quarterly earnings report. And next in science is Pluto a Planet by Kenneth Chang. Who doesn't love Pluto? It shares a name with the Roman god of the underworld and a Disney dog. But is it a planet? This debate about the icy world that used to be the ninth planet of the solar system is as much linguistics as science, and it's not a question with simple answers. But it's a fascinating story about an ancient word with shifting meanings, humanity's evolving views of its place in the cosmos, and the process of scientific discovery, which, like all human endeavors, can be messy and contentious. Are you opening to changing your mind about Pluto? Well, let's ask a few questions to see where you stand on this question of planetary importance. Do you think Pluto should be considered a planet? Well, 68% people said yes and 32% no. Pluto was a planet before and now it's not. Science and its terminology change, and you're fine with whatever the scientists decide. As revealed during the flyby by NASA's New Horizons spacecraft in 2015, Pluto is a world with soaring ice mountains, chaotic and mottled terrain, possibly a subsurface ocean, and even an icy plain in the shape of a heart. And it's fascinating, regardless of whether it's called a planet or a dwarf planet. The vast majority of college freshmen were about 4 years old when Pluto was demoted in 2006, but the tussling over Pluto's status is not over yet. A group of planetary scientists recently revisited the argument. Meanwhile, astronomers are scanning even farther out in our solar system for something that might indeed be large enough to qualify as a planet. Well, what's the definition of planet again? To be considered a planet, a solar system body must directly orbit around the sun, have sufficient mass to attain what's known as hydrostatic equilibrium, that is, gravity pulls it into a nearly round shape, and have cleared the neighborhood around its orbit. The third condition, which in essence says a planet must be the gravitational bully in its part of the solar system and push smaller bodies out of its way, is the most controversial. Another weirdness, it only defines planets within our solar system. It doesn't apply to planets around other stars. But is Pluto a planet is the wrong question, or at least it's not the only question. Consider these other places in the solar system. Do you think Eris, E-R-I-S, is a planet? Well, let's explain a bit more, because it's almost a twin of Pluto. Eris was the domino that led to the relegation of Pluto to a new category, dwarf planets. Mike Brown, the California Institute of Technology astronomer who discovered Eris, had spent years systematically searching the night skies for large bodies in the ring of debris beyond Neptune, known as the Kuiper Belt, K-U-I-P-E-R. Pluto is part of the Kuiper Belt, but for decades astronomers did not know that the Kuiper Belt existed. In 1992, a second belt object, now named Albion, was discovered. Now thousands of these icy worlds have been found. During the first few years of his sky survey, Dr. Brown found several sizable worlds and gave them names like Quaoar, that's Q-U-A-O-A-R, and Sedna, S-E-D-N-A. But these were much smaller than Pluto and thus didn't threaten Pluto's planetary status. Then, on January 5, 2005, Dr. Brown spotted a bright dot on his computer screen and its position shifted during three exposures of the same patch of the night sky. That meant it was moving and not fixed like distant stars. It was so bright that a quick calculation suggested it was bigger than Pluto. Turns out that Pluto, at 1,473 miles in diameter, is a smidgen 30 miles wider than Eris. Now that something the size of Pluto had been discovered, astronomers could no easily sidestep the question, what's a planet? There was actually no formal scientific definition. If Pluto were to remain a planet, then Eris almost certainly had to be counted as one too. But what about Quaoar and Sedna? Should they also be planets? And it was inevitable that many more sizable icy worlds would be discovered in the outer solar system in the coming years. How about Ceres? Should Ceres be a planet? Well, 12% of respondents said yes, and 44% no, and 44% said, "I've never heard of this place. Wasn't Ceres the three-headed dog guarding the gates of the underworld?" Well, you're thinking of Cerberus from Greek mythology, and Ceres is also a figure in mythology, the Roman name for Demeter, the goddess of agriculture. Ceres, like Pluto, is a former planet, one that most people have never heard of. It does make a prominent appearance in the television and book series The Expanse. Ceres, C-E-R-E-S, is the largest of the asteroids in an orbit around the Sun between Mars and Jupiter. The Italian astronomer Giuseppe Piazzi discovered it on January 1, 1801, a couple of decades after William Herschel had discovered Uranus. The distance of Uranus from the Sun fit well with a mathematical relationship that seemed to predict the orbits of the planets. The same mathematical relationship also predicted a planet in the space between Mars and Jupiter, so astronomers started looking there. Piazzi found Ceres, a new planet, but Ceres is too dim to be seen by the unaided eye and was just a point of light, even through telescopes. That meant it had to be tiny compared to the other planets. Then another planet, Pallas, P-A-L-L-A-S, was discovered the following year in an almost the same orbit. Yet another Juno was spotted in 1804 and another Vesta in 1807. These were clearly much smaller than and different from the other planets. How could there be a multitude of planets circling the Sun in the same part of space? Astronomers called these minor planets. William Herschel called them asteroids, star-like objects, because they were just points of light like stars, but they moved across the night sky. By the end of the 19th century, Ceres, Pallas, Juno, and Vesta were dropped from the most lists of planets, at least among the general public, although astronomers still used minor planet as a synonym for asteroid. Last question. Should Earth's moon be called a planet too? Well, 6% said, sure, why not? It's round. It's bigger than Pluto. 94% said, no, what part of moon do you not understand? Yep, you agree with a group of planetary scientists who are arguing that historically, this is the way that scientists dating back to Galileo have used the word planet to mean a complex, Earth-like world. They say that it was only in the 19th century that the meaning gave way to what they call an unscientific folk taxonomy. How did this happen? Well, hint, blame the astrologers. If you're confused, you're not the only one. Scientific definitions are usually not decided by a vote. After all, it would be strange if an international body of botanists passed a resolution to declare that cucumbers should be recognized as fruits, not vegetables, and geologists don't need to weigh in on whether Europe should be considered a continent separate from Asia. But with the widespread interest in the topic and the conflicting opinions, the leadership of the International Astronomical Union felt it important to weigh in. And continuing on, today, Tuesday, January 18th, New York Times, is Pluto a planet? Well, the International Astronomical Union felt it was important to weigh in, and there are really only two scientifically reasonable possibilities. The current definition that embodies the idea that planets are the big things that orbit the Sun, and the other idea that planets should be anything that's big enough to be round, and thus to undergo interesting geologic processes. Perhaps the best answer is that it depends. There are two opposing views, and in contrast to evolution and climate change, the different scientific views are both reasonable and scientifically valid. For astrophysicists, planets are like the detritus left over from formation of much, much larger structures, like the clumping of dark matter and the collapsing of gas clouds into galaxies. In our solar system, for example, the Sun accounts for more than 99.8% of the mass. For the astrophysicists, planets are essentially the solar system's equivalent of continents, the few big pieces decided upon somewhat arbitrarily by historical convention. Why are Europe and Asia separate continents when they're solidly connected? Why is Australia a continent and not just a big island? How much larger would Greenland need to be called a continent? Yes, it turns out that Australia sits on its own tectonic plate and Greenland is part of the North American plate, but that only became clear in the 1960s, centuries after people started using the word continent. Geologists, at least, do not feel the need to vote on a definition of continent. Hal Levinson, an astrophysicist at the Southwest Research Institute in Boulder, Colorado, points out a problem with using roundness as the defining quality of a planet. How round is round enough? No matter how one devises a definition of roundness, there will be two objects almost identical to one another, one that will be slightly just epsilon, bigger than the other, Dr. Levinson said. and one of them will be a planet, and the other won't. Planetary scientists, not surprisingly, have a decidedly planet-centric view of the universe. All of the really interesting stuff, they say, happens on planets. Planets are engines of complexity, said Phil Metzger, a planetary scientist at the University of Central Florida and the lead author of a newly published paper in the journal Icarus that argues for a more inclusive definition of planet. When you get a body of a certain size, then these geological and chemical and even biological processes begin, he said, and you have this emerging, this flowering of complexity. That's really what the useful definition of a planet has always been. That complexity, Dr. Metzger argued, does not depend on the orbit, such as whether the body originally orbited the sun and was then captured as a moon, which is what occurred with Triton, Neptune's largest moon. In that sense, you're using the word planet in the way river is used. There's not an infinite number of rivers on Earth, but rivers are also not a countable quantity. What's the dividing line between a stream and a river? If a river sometimes dries up, it's still a river? And scientists who study rivers don't worry about particulars like this. Perhaps the International Astronomical Union should have just left planet undefined. Why is it so hard to define planet? Well, the crux of the dispute, what makes a planet a planet? Should a planet be defined by what is, some specification of size or composition or shape? Or should it be defined by what it does, that it goes around the sun, or both? Well, the word planet derives from the Greek word for wanderer. To the ancients, the Earth seemed to be the obvious, unmoving center of the universe. Stars seemed to be fixed points of light on a distant, rotating globe. But a few brighter spots stood out against the cosmic background. These were Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. The moon and the sun were originally counted as planets because, although they were immensely larger, they also wandered across the sky. Thus, the original definition of planet was intrinsically a dynamical one. It described the motion of an object in the sky and nothing about it, what it was. Then a few centuries ago came the realization that the Earth is not the center of the universe. Who proposed the idea that the sun is the center of the solar system? Nicholas Copernicus. In the 16th century, Nicholas Copernicus, a Polish astronomer, proposed that the planets orbited the sun, not the Earth. And indeed, Earth was just a planet going around the sun. Only the moon went around the Earth. The idea, the heliocentric model of the universe, wasn't readily accepted. A few decades later, the Catholic Church famously prosecuted Galileo for heresy, for believing in heliocentrism. Galileo added to the fuzziness of the word planet when, looking through his telescope at Jupiter in January 1610, he spotted four dimmer points of light, which turned out to be four large moons, Io, Europa, Callisto, and Ganymede. Except moon did not mean what it means today. Moon was just the name of Earth's moon. Astronomers then tried to clarify their terminology, calling planets that orbited the sun primary planets, and the objects orbiting a planet secondary planets. Secondary planets were also called satellites and then moons because they orbited a planet in the same way that Earth's moon orbits Earth. Uranus was discovered in 1781. Neptune in 1846, and Pluto in 1930. And that was how the idea of the nine planets got fixed in school children's minds for decades. The planet story might change again, and maybe very soon. The existence of Neptune was predicted from slight perturbations in the orbits of Saturn and Uranus. Now something seems to be pushing some of the most distant ice balls, those orbiting far beyond Neptune, and most of the Kuiper Belt. Dr. Brown, who upended the solar system once with the discovery of Eris, believes there's a big object, something big enough to justify the moniker of planet in the distant solar system. In 2016, he and a Caltech colleague, Konstantin Batygin, first published calculations that pointed to what they called Planet Nine. Others were skeptical, but the subtle clustering of orbits could just be a figment of statistics based on observations of fewer than a dozen objects. In a paper published last fall, they took into account more recent observations and argued that what they saw was almost certainly real, with an only 0.4% chance that it was a result of chance. They also adjusted their predictions for the orbit and size. The hypothesized object is a bit closer to the sun and smaller than they thought. Even a bit closer is still far out, more than 60 times farther from the Sun than Neptune. Dr. Brown and Dr. Battigan now think Planet 9 is about 6 times the mass of Earth at the lower end of their earlier estimate, that it would be between 5 and 20 times the mass of Earth. But because it should be closer, it could be brighter and easier to spot. We now have basically a map on the sky of where to look, how bright it should be in different places, Dr. Brown said. But with this treasure map, combined with a computer program to sift through old images, we can very systematically start to rule out the parts of the sky that we need to rule out until we're done. So far, searches of the sky have come up empty, and now he's searching through old images of the sky that might have captured Planet 9 without its being recognized for what it was. The analysis of the old data should be finished soon, perhaps within weeks, and that should cover about 3/4 of the possibilities. If we find it, we're going to announce it as soon as we can, Dr. Brown said. There's no way we could keep it secret for any amount of time. If Planet 9 doesn't show up, then more sky observations will be needed, probably by the powerful Vera Rubin Observatory in Chile, which may begin observations this year. Planet 9, if it exists, would assuredly revive the debate over what a planet is. Dr. Brown, who did not think Eris merited planethood, thinks Planet 9 would definitely qualify, and it would be the 5th largest object orbiting the Sun, after Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. That's not something slightly 1 centimeter larger than Pluto, he said. Let's all continue arguing about Pluto. This is kind of the thing that makes you realize why saying Pluto's not a planet was a good idea to begin with, because there still could be actual planets out there to be found. Final thoughts. Science is not a popularity contest. It can be complicated. And scientists don't always agree, but within the differences of opinion often lie intriguing nuances of knowledge. And next in books in the New York Times, nonfiction, A Black Graduate of an Elite Boarding School Gets Real. This is by Lacey Crawford. Admissions is a memoir of surviving boarding school, early in her memoir by Kendra James. Admissions. The author describes an off-campus adventure near her new boarding school. The students who accompany her are, like James, black, among the few black students at Taft, an elite school that, like so many of its kind, was built for wealthy white boys. Wandering the Connecticut countryside, James and her friends take a goose egg from a nest. They schedule its care using dormitory lamps to warm the unhatched gosling, which James names Crookshanks. The egg is moved from lonely desk to lonely desk. When school staff members eventually discover the egg, unbroken and fetid, in James' room, James isn't present. A white peer has accused her of stealing $20, and James has made an excruciating calculation. Because she lacks the resources on her own to expose the interpersonal and institutional racism driving the conflict, falsely claiming responsibility is the easiest way to continue her education. James confesses and is suspended. And the staff find the egg, which James writes had partially broken open in their hands, sending the smell of rotting egg and partially developed goose through the hall. She adds, "I was fine with this. No tears for Crookshanks." But the reader holds the loss, which is not about the bird, of course, but about teenagers trying to make a home in a place that has admitted them without extending to them a sense of belonging. It's one of the series of heartaches James layers into her fresh, funny memoir. For James and for students like her, Taft is no nest, but it might have been. James was the first black American legacy at Taft, legacy here meaning the child or grandchild or great-grandchild of a graduate. One previous black alumnus whose daughter attended was Bermudan. The distinction would have been lost on members of the white community at Taft, but it's critical to James. James' father, originally from Chicago's South Side, entered Taft through a scholarship program, and by the time James enrolls, he's a trustee. Taft, she writes, was simply inevitable, but she feels alienated from other black students because of an upbringing long on, in quotes, respectability politics, end quotes, and from white students who don't view their black and Latino peers as integral to their school. Why is James, class of 2006, the first black American legacy? Because most black alumni choose not to send their children. Year after year, black students confront their, in quotes, innate otherness in this institution, end quotes, while the institution remains unchanged. This paradox, with the sociologist Seamus Khan has described as a more diverse elite with a more unequal world, is laid carefully bare in Admissions. Black students at Taft are ignored, except for their race, but James is not one to be ignored. She dresses boldly, including, in quotes, a hemp cobra-stitched chain with a large paw print bead in the center. that symbolize my love for Cyrus Black and embraces the world of fantasy. Her descriptions often rely on idiosyncratic figures. At one point, James Alex Maxed my way off a chair. Pre-season 6 Willow from Buffy the Vampire Slayer is a style influence. Where I got James' references, I laughed. Where I had to look them up, I appreciated the enactment of her unwelcoming boarding school appearance. There is a whole culture here. You'd better learn it. James' voice is swift, charming, and surprising, and it's delightful to follow her as she richly imagined dreams of boarding school and are replaced by deep friendships, self-compassion, and humor. James' gift in admissions is to provide company for Black students in predominantly white spaces. The work of admissions is laying down, with wit and care, the burden James assumed at 15 years old that she, or any Black student, or all Black students, would manage the failures of a racially illiterate community. After graduation, James finds that white classmates suddenly embrace her as though it was normal, something we'd always just done. Suddenly, outside Taft's gates, I was a person. This phenomenon is about the best depiction of elite whiteness I've read, nailing the belonging derived from institutional affiliation, which is therefore impersonal and false, but manifests value in spite of this. James writes to illuminate her experience as a Black student at Taft. She throws just as much light on the school's whiteness. And next, a guest essay and opinion, The CDC and FDA Can Work Better Together. This is by Joshua M. Sharfstein. At this difficult moment of the pandemic, a great deal of distress is the result of a basic disconnect, even as Americans hear frightening news about record numbers of infections and hospitalizations. There's a growing confusion about testing, booster doses, and medications, the very tools we use to protect ourselves from COVID-19. Closing this gap isn't the job of one federal agency, it's the job of two. The pandemic has pushed the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the Food and Drug Administration to the front lines of the nation's response. Scientists at the CDC are tracking every twist and turn in the pandemic, while their counterparts at FDA oversee the technologies that keep us safe. Among the agency's major challenges, however, has been working together. Absent a national crisis, both the CDC and the FDA generally stay in their own corners when it comes to medical interventions. The CDC is most known for leading outbreak investigations, publishing public health recommendations, and supporting the work of state and local health departments. The FDA sets regulatory policy, reviews confidential drug and device applications from companies, and decides whether to permit products to be marketed. There are good reasons for why the agencies largely do their work apart. Under Title 21 of the U.S. Code on Food and Drugs, the FDA has the special authority to make regulatory decisions and the responsibility to do so with integrity. Under Title 42, which governs public health and welfare, the CDC analyzes data from around the world about emerging threats. Day to day, the FDA interacts with companies, patient groups, and consumer advocates, while the CDC engages with states and localities. In Congress, the two agencies report to different subcommittees. At times, White Oak, Maryland, and Atlanta can feel like worlds apart. When I worked at the FDA, it wasn't uncommon for agency officials to consider correspondence from CDC experts on regulatory questions equivalent to a letter sent in from the public. The usual division of labor, however, has not worked well during the pandemic, and the public's been confused by the lack of clarity around how recommendations are made for vaccines and by the finger-pointing when problems arise. It doesn't have to be this way. Both the CDC and the FDA share the mission of protecting and advancing public health. Greater cooperation would improve the nation's response to COVID. That's all the time we have today. I'm Barbara Tobias. This has been the New York Times on Tuesday, January 18th. Stay well.